Hello, my name's John Dennis. It's Tuesday, November the 11th. Today, can a package of tax cuts help Britain beat the credit crunch?
Stimulus to the economy, keep the economy ticking over, help to restore confidence in the system. They're all speaking the same sort of language now. They're just disagreeing as to how best to do it.
Details have emerged of a secret order from the White House authorising raids on countries not at war with the United States. Another item in the in-tray of President-elect Barack Obama.
He may well be surprised by some of the revelations that are now coming out about what Bush and co are up to.
And scientists discover a gene that makes anyone who's got it more likely to become addicted to cocaine.
What they found, which I think was really interesting, was that this particular gene they had first found in mice was far more common in the cocaine addicts who were around in real life. They were all from Brazil, and it seems to make you far more susceptible to becoming an addict.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, the news headlines and a look at the papers with Sandy Waugh.
The US President-elect Barack Obama has made his first visit to the White House since winning last week's election. President Bush showed him round the Oval Office, while Laura Bush showed Michelle Obama on a tour of the living quarters. Bush and Obama then had an hour's discussion, which was about foreign policy and the economy, according to a spokesman. The Obama team are reported to be drawing up plans to close the detention centre at Guantanamo Bay, which is still holding 250 detainees. The plan is to release some and bring up to 80 others to court in the USA. But a White House spokesman warned the process will not be that easy. The Prime Minister Gordon Brown said last night that the election of Obama was a dawn of hope. In his annual foreign policy speech to the Lord Mayor's banquet, Brown said he looked forward to a new multilateralism in which cooperation, not confrontation, flourishes as an answer to challenges. He listed a number of targets: arms reduction, peace in Afghanistan and Iraq, a climate change agreement and a world strategy for reflating the economy. Brown also mentioned his plan for limited tax cuts to help dissuade businesses from cutting jobs. Both the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives have also said they want tax cuts to combat the recession, as we'll hear later in Guardian Daily. Meanwhile, more bad economic news. The number of house sales has fallen to a 30-year low, according to the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors. And the British Retail Consortium says sales in our shops were also down last month. They've dropped in 7 of the last 8 months. The Financial Times puts that story as its front page lead, which it calls a plunge in sales. The Independent warns us banks are raising the cost of credit cards in spite of the cost of borrowing being the lowest in 50 years. The Telegraph and The Guardian both lead on reports of what the government may be planning to deal with the economic problems. The Guardian reports that a leaked letter from Lord Mandelson argues the post office could be saved by giving it much more rights to offer financial services. The letter says that the business could offer a wide range of financial services within easy reach of the whole population from an institution they can trust. The Telegraph says the Chancellor will postpone the increase in car tax planned to start next year. It's long been a subject of complaint as a so-called poll tax on wheels, but new cars may still face the new green tax. Several papers carry jolly pictures of the Bushes meeting the Obamas, but the Mail portrays the French president and his wife meeting our Prince Charles and Camilla. It shows a French elegant hand kissing, which makes both the ladies smile, under the caption, "Smoothie Sarko charms Camilla." In total contrast, the Mirror and the Telegraph choose a picture of 13-year-old Hannah Jones, who suffers from leukemia. She's been allowed to refuse a heart transplant, even though that means she's likely to die. The most surprising story on the back sports pages is in The Sun, which says that Manchester City's Arab owners had to make an offer to Jose Mourinho to return to England. But at Chelsea, which Mourinho left after disagreements with owner Roman Abramovich, there are reports there's no more money to buy new players because the owner lost billions on the stock market. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The Bank of England is expected tomorrow to revise its growth forecasts and concede that Britain is entering a recession. With that in mind, the government is preparing a package of tax cuts to encourage consumer spending, but it'll be funded by an increase in borrowing. In a moment, we'll find out what political commentator Michael White makes of that. But first, business correspondent Philip Inman explains the thinking behind the tax cuts being drawn up by the government.
The government's really concerned that the interest rate cuts from the Bank of England are not going to have the desired effect, that the people aren't going to get out there and spend money because they've had this interest rate cut, and that they need more encouragement. And I think that's where the drive comes from to say, OK, maybe tax cuts is what we need to do, combine this.
The Institute for Fiscal Studies says it'll need to be worth £15 billion for any package of tax cuts to make any difference.
Well, the Institute of Fiscal Studies says that you've got to start thinking about that kind of figure if you're going to make a real boost. I mean, they're not recommending it. They're not saying that's what should be done. But they're saying if you're in government and you're thinking that this interest rate is not going to have the desired effect, then that's the kind of figure you're talking about. They said 1% of national income, and that adds up to 15 billion. And that's the kind of cut we're talking about. Although then we get into, where might you apply those cuts?
Well, indeed. I mean, for £15 billion worth of tax cuts to make a difference, i.e. for people actually to go back into the economy and spend the money, what kind of people need to be targeted?
Well, we know that the target audience fits in lots of ways, and that's some low and middle income families. They're the people who go out and spend money because they've got to, and they're the people who are really strapped for cash at the moment, and they are the target audience for the government in so many ways. I mean, their child poverty targets need to be met, you know, so you'd be handing money out to people who you want to not slip back down the income scale and fall back into poverty. It would achieve lots of things if you target your money at those people. Obviously, you don't want to give it to the rich, as George Bush did on so many occasions during his presidency. You want it to go to the lower income groups.
So what are the risks inherent in the government failing to balance its books at a time when you know, the rest of us are having to do just that with our household budgets?
Well, a lot of people say that it's a great risk. You know, should we really be having tax cuts at this time? You know, when will you be able to pay it back? You know, most of the taxes have been paid by the finance companies up to now, the banks. Well, they're not going to be making any money for a very long time, so they're not going to be paying their corporation tax to any great degree. Neither will all the other people who've been paying lots of corporation tax, like house builders and property companies and all the rest of it. That's not going to happen for a very long time. So there's an argument that says it'd be totally irresponsible to go out and offer tax cuts at this moment in time. In fact, what you should do is you should go in and kick the Bank of England again and say, cut interest rates even further. It's interest rates that will put money straight into people's pockets, that will allow them to go out and spend it now and get us through the recession, and that's where it should come from.
Philip Inman. Well, Gordon Brown, David Cameron and Nick Clegg are all calling for tax cuts. How do the tax cuts being proposed by the government differ from those proposed by the Lib Dems and the Tories? In Westminster, The Guardian's political commentator, Michael White.
The Lib Dems and the Tories spent last night's Commons debate, organised by Vince Cable, the Lib Dem shadow chancellor, as they call them. This was before the Prime Minister spoke at the Mansion House, setting out their own plans for making the banking system and indeed the whole financial system and the wider economy work better. And I suppose you could say the basic difference between the Lib Dems and the Tories is that the Lib Dems would cut taxes, particularly for lower earners, and increase taxes on higher earners and some green taxes as well to pay for it, whereas the Tories would also cut taxes, particularly at the bottom end, but cut public expenditure to pay for it. And both of them were concerned to say, whatever the government does in the next few weeks, you mustn't have what they call unfunded tax cuts, because we'll end up having to pay for it all in the end. So you might as well, if you're going to cut taxes to stimulate the economy, then you've got to balance it, not by borrowing, but by finding the money elsewhere.
Until recently, the Conservatives were saying the cupboard was bare as regards tax cuts.
They were indeed, but everything changes. And I think what's happened in recent weeks is the realisation across the world that this recession is what the pessimists have been saying for a year or so. Academic economists and others in Britain and America who've been predicting the whole thing might cost $3 trillion. For trillion dollars, looks as if they're going to be proved right. Man called Rubini at New York University, very bearish, as they say, about that. So what we were saying a month or so ago no longer applies. The need is not to worry about inflation, which we were worrying about, but the fear of a deflationary spiral. Deflation is much worse than inflation. So stimulus to the economy, keep the economy ticking over, help to restore confidence in the system. They're all speaking the same sort sort of language now. They're just disagreeing as to how best to do it.
If the Conservatives oppose the government's particular package of tax cuts, we don't know whether they will, of course, but if they do, do they run the risk of losing their mantle as the party of tax cuts?
Well, it is a dilemma for David Cameron and his shadow chancellor, George Osborne, because they know that Alistair Darling, the chancellor, is producing the annual pre-budget report, which in many ways will be much more like a budget this year within the next couple of weeks, not quite sure when. And they know that if they oppose tax cuts, particularly for the poorest, and it's not just about income tax, of course, it's possibly child benefit. That's one idea that's been floated. We don't know yet. You increase child benefit, cut taxes, other benefits, because, of course, the benefit of giving money to poorer people is they spend it quicker. You cut taxes for the rich, well, maybe they'll spend it, maybe they'll put it in a bank. What bank? So it affects the economy more dramatically, more quickly, and that's what we need, and that's what the one-off tax payment, which the Bush administration put into the American system this autumn, they, so far as we can tell, has had a benevolent effect of keeping the economy ticking over, even though the US is in recession. And although we don't use the word here, we talk about economic downturn still, it's pretty clear the UK is in recession too.
Do you think that Gordon Brown will follow his success in getting countries to coordinate their bailout of the banking system with a sort of global call for coordinated tax cuts in the UK, the US and Europe?
Well, telling other governments to cut taxes is, you know, none of our business, frankly. What Mr. Brown did at the Mansion House last night was renew his recent plea for a restructuring of the Bretton Woods system created at the end of World War II, and you know, to make it more fitting the realities of a much more globalized economy than existed then. He's been calling for it for a long time. Nobody took any notice of him until recently, but now you know, that's more the mood of the major economies. Harder to do than it looks, of course.
Michael White, and there's full coverage of the government's stance on tax cuts and the Gordon Brown's Mansion House speech last night. guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on the Guardian's website today, Cambridgeshire Chief Constable Julie Spence, a possible successor to Sir Ian Blair as Metropolitan Police Chief, talks to Patrick Barkham at guardian.co.uk/G2. 90 years after the First World War, you can view portraits, sketches and manuscripts from the poets Wilfred Owen, Rupert Graves and Isaac Rosenberg, among others, at guardian.co.uk/books. And Adam Sampson argues that short-term council tenancies are a bad idea that won't run. Have your say on that and much else at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. On October the 26th, American Special Forces carried out a raid into Syrian territory to attack what they said were terrorist targets. According to a report in the New York Times, it was one of several military operations in countries with which the United States is not at war. The order was authorised in 2004 from the White House. Foreign Affairs columnist Simon Tisdall has the details.
Well, apparently it was put together by Donald Rumsfeld, who was then Defence Secretary, and it gave authority to US Special Forces, US Navy SEALs and other type of commandos of that type, to go to launch cross-border ground and air raids into countries with which the United States was not at war. So at that time, the United States had been in Iraq for about a year and was already had troops in Afghanistan. We were talking about countries neighbouring those two, such as Pakistan or Syria, but also countries that may have been harbouring al-Qaeda sympathisers or operatives, such as some of the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. We know that the US launched drone attacks against al-Qaeda targets in Yemen in the early part of the decade. But some of the countries aren't mentioned in this report. It may be that they belong to the Arab countries of the Maghreb, for instance.
What about Somalia?
Somalia is basically a turkey shoot for US forces. They declared their own control over Somali airspace and Somali coastline and have established a base, an old French Foreign Legion base, up in Djibouti, Camp Lemonnier. And from there, they have regularly, it seems, mounted raids into what is an ungoverned space. There's no viable government in Somalia, against targets of opportunity, particularly the Al-Shabaab militia, which again is linked to Al-Qaeda, has similar points of view and is supported by the Eritreans, against the Ethiopian army, which is currently in Somalia, which is supported indirectly by the United States.
Iran borders both Iraq and Afghanistan. Did the 2004 order go as far as to authorise attacks or incursions into Iranian territory?
Well, as I understand it, the 2004 order said, doesn't exclude any country. I mean, you could have special forces operating in Devon, as far as I know. But I don't think they've done that in Devon, and I don't think that so far they've done it in Iran, because unlike some of these weaker states, Iran would not grin and bear it, would not take it on the chin. Iran would make a big fuss and would probably almost certainly retaliate. There does seem to have been some air reconnaissance over Iranian territory, but no direct US incursions. I mean, following the raid into Syria last month, there was concern that the US, which claims that there are training camps for terrorists on Iranian territory, would use that as a reason to go into Iran. But I think it's far too sensitive politically, diplomatically, and militarily for them really to contemplate doing that. It would be a major gamble, because Iran could easily hit back at US and coalition forces in Iraq and Afghanistan.
This sort of does all chime with what we know about George Bush's view of what constitutes legitimate self-defence. Would this policy continue under President Barack Obama?
Well, like so many things at the moment, that's a bit up in the air. Obama took a fairly tough line during the campaign on terrorism. He supports an escalation of troop levels in Afghanistan, which is a controversial idea. He also says that he would support cross-border raids against al-Qaeda targets in Pakistan if that were necessary and actionable. It's not clear whether he will adopt the whole apparatus of the war on terror or even wants to use that terminology, which is quite problematic, as you know. Maybe he wants to try and fashion a less bellicose approach to dealing with Islamic fundamentalism than that under the Bush administration. It's really not clear what he will do. However, he may well be surprised by some of the revelations that are now coming out about what Bush and co are up to. I mean, we do think we know a lot of what has been going on, but I'm sure there's a lot more that we don't know.
Simon Tisdall. My name's John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, 9 so-called healthy towns pioneer new schemes to reduce obesity.
I was talking to the project director in Manchester, which is going to be one of them, and they've got a sort of quite space-age idea of monitoring stations around on cycle tracks and jogging routes.
A study from the Institute of Psychiatry has found a genetic link to cocaine addiction. Ian Sample, our science correspondent, explains why your genes affect the likelihood of becoming addicted to cocaine.
Well, this is a study which has shown that after looking in mice, which had different genetic makeups, a bunch of scientists found that there was a certain variant of a gene in some of these mice, made them far more strongly addicted to cocaine. And these are those kinds of experiments where you allow mice access to a sort of a drip of cocaine and they can go and take it when they want to. And you look at how their addiction develops. What was particularly interesting about this study is after identifying this gene in mice, they then went and looked to see how common it was in human drug addicts and non-users, non-drug users. And what they found, which I think was really interesting, was that this particular gene they had first found in mice was far more common in the cocaine addicts who were around in real life. They were all from Brazil, and it seems to make you far more susceptible to becoming an addict.
Although it doesn't mean that you'll necessarily become addicted, and of course anybody could become addicted to cocaine.
That's right. Although the scientists I've been speaking to have said, well, look, we think that your risk of becoming a cocaine addict in your life is about 70% genetic. And I find that extraordinarily high, because you'd think, well, surely it just comes down to whether you try it or not. But, you know, I think that may well involve some sort of other environmental factors of when you're being brought up by a parent who does that. But it does seem to have a strong genetic component. And although at this stage they're not able to say exactly how much this particular gene increases your risk, they just know that it does.
Might genetic factors influence addiction to other drugs?
Oh, we know absolutely that it does, although interestingly, cocaine is one of the more genetic ones. With alcoholism, for example, people seem to think from studies on twins, and there are far more people who are alcoholics than there are cocaine addicts, so the data is a lot stronger. But that link, those studies seem to suggest that about 50% of your risk of alcoholism is genetic and the rest being environmental.
How might this study affect the treatment of cocaine addiction?
I think in the near term or even in the medium term, this particular study won't help us find a cure for cocaine addiction. But what is interesting about it is a lot of other scientists are working on what you could call a cocaine vaccine. There is a lot of proof to suggest that you could inject a human with something that would give them antibodies to the cocaine molecule. So what you could use this particular study for is finding those people who are really susceptible to becoming addicts. So you would screen their genome if their parents are addicts or such like, and you would say this person is incredibly high risk of becoming a cocaine addict. You would maybe then offer them a cocaine vaccine and you'd reduce your costs, and also it would be, you know, the patient's choice to take that.
Dudley, Halifax, Sheffield, Thetford, Middlesbrough, Manchester, Tewkesbury, Portsmouth, and the London Borough of Tower Hamlets. They've all been designated by the government as healthy towns. The plan is that the NHS and local authorities will use modern marketing techniques to reward people who adopt healthier lifestyles. John Carville is our social affairs editor.
I think we need to appreciate that healthy towns start off being unhealthy. Healthy is what they're going to become. Actually, they're towns with quite high levels of obesity at the moment. And what's going to happen is a variety of different ideas. I was talking to the project director in Manchester, which is going to be one of them, and they've got a sort of quite space age idea of monitoring stations around on cycle tracks and jogging routes, where they would be able to follow your progress. You'd carry a tag. The monitoring station would be able to tell how far you'd cycled or how far you'd jogged. They'd work out the calories that you must have used to have done that. And you'd then get rewards, a bit like a sort of supermarket reward scheme or a Nectar reward scheme. And you could get your prizes.
So they're trying to get these towns to come up with ideas themselves on how to combat obesity.
That's right. First of all, they needed to be problem towns. Then they needed to show the most innovation and enthusiasm. And so, in a sense, these nine towns, the ones that have won the competition, and they'll be starting at various stages over the next few months to change people's behaviour.
Does it suggest that the government's run out of ideas itself on how to combat obesity?
I think if Alan Johnson had got up and said, right then, everyone at 7 o'clock is going to be out in front of their houses doing the following exercises, we'd have given him a big raspberry. So I think the idea of getting the local NHS, local authorities, local businesses to come up with ideas is the right way. And whether or not the government has ideas, we wouldn't have followed them if they'd said it anyway. So this is right.
And how are they getting the involvement of food retailers? How does that work?
I'm not entirely clear. In some areas, I think there may again be reward points. So if you choose the whole meal alternative, that might be something working in the till that gets you extra points. In others, there may be direct incentives. For instance, in Tower Hamlets in London, on the route that people will travel to get to the Olympic Park, there are going to be incentives for fast food retailers to stock a healthier alternative. And so there the incentive might work the other way. It's an incentive on the retailer.
And you mentioned the Olympics. This is in part part of the government's pledge to get people more active as in the run-up to the 2012 Olympics.
It is. I've always had difficulty with this idea that an obesity campaign, which is essentially aimed at the couch potatoes and people like me who take far too little exercise, there's no way I'm going to be in for the Olympics. But maybe the ideas are associated, so that's fair enough.
Well, as a self-confessed couch potato, John, does any of this tempt you to get on your joggers and get out there and get some exercise?
Well, I think some of these ideas are rather good, but I have to say that at this stage, some of them are still wrapped up in quite a bit of jargon. I noticed, for example, that Portsmouth is promising initiatives including reviewing the existing transport and infrastructure network, developing localised time-distance-based signage. We're going to have localized time distance based signage, route planning and information resources to support independent walking and cycling. I think if I want independent walking, I can manage that.
John Carville. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.